The doctrine of discovery is the current system of laws and policies that justify the removal of land from indigenous peoples. These laws are rooted in church doctrines that originated in the 15th century.
Together, we will uncover this deep structure of colonization that systematically deprives indigenous peoples of human rights.
I'm Sherry Hostetler, and I helped start a coalition of Anabaptist people of faith that seek to dismantle the doctrine of discovery. I'm also a Mennonite pastor in San Francisco.
And I'm Sarah Augustine, and I also helped start this coalition. As an activist and scholar, I'm the descendant of the Tewa people and a displaced person. This is the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery podcast.
In this episode, we talk with Richard Heinberg, one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our reliance on fossil fuels. He is the author of 14 books, including some of the seminal works on society's current energy and environmental sustainability crisis. His latest book, which I highly recommend, is Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival. Now, I could go on and on, Richard, with your bio, but I'm not going to.
Good.
You can go to his website to find out more. And there will be, you'll check out the show notes. I will also just say he's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, which is one of the main places that I go to get information and analysis and some measure of sanity about the poly crisis in which we find ourselves. Richard, I have been a fangirl of yours for years.
Aww.
Your clear and complex analysis has really deeply influenced me. And Sarah's and my most recent book, So That We and Our Children Might Live Following Jesus and Confronting the Climate Crisis, I said that right. Our most recent book is really indebted to you and your work, the work that you've really been doing for decades now.
Oh,
so welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah and Sherry. And it's such a pleasure to hear that. It's so great to know that my work has had some influence. Thank you.
So I'm going to start with the first question, which is just a very basic question about what's the matter with green growth or the green energy revolution? I mean, what's not to like about renewables and batteries and electric cars? And, you know, why won't this save us?
Right. Well, I've written a lot on this subject, and so I could go on at some length. But in a nutshell, you know, over the last 200 years, we got used to using fossil fuels, and fossil fuels gave us vastly more energy than we were accustomed to before. And they enabled us to increase the size of our economies, the human population on the planet, agricultural production, everything. Energy is at the heart of everything we do. And with fossil fuels, we suddenly had access to tens of millions of years worth of energy that we could burn in, you know, just a couple of centuries. So that got us to living in a way that is fundamentally unsustainable. You know, the ways that we use energy in the modern world, it's at a scale and speed that is completely unprecedented in all of biological history and human history. So now we find ourselves in this crisis situation where, you know, burning fossil fuels is changing the chemistry of the atmosphere, changing the chemistry of the oceans, putting all life on the planet at risk. Meanwhile, fossil fuels themselves are non-renewable resources that are depleting in real time. So we've got to get off of fossil fuels. So obviously the first thing folks want to do is turn to alternative sources of energy to keep us living the same way we currently are, only without climate change and all the other nasty stuff. But the problem there is, and by the way, I drive an electric car. I have solar panels on my roof. I'm not saying that these are horrible things, but they're just stopgap measures to try to keep us doing these unsustainable things for a little bit longer until we can figure something else out. I've co-authored a book on renewable energy called Our Renewable Future. My co-author is David Fridley, who's on the energy analysis team at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. We took a year to examine, you know, what is world energy usage like right now? How would it have to change in order to go all renewable? What are the opportunities? What are the constraints on making a full transition to renewables? And again, I could go on about this for quite some time, but in a nutshell, renewable energy sources like solar and wind are intermittent. The sun doesn't always shine, wind doesn't always blow. So we make up for that in three ways. One, with energy storage, like batteries, which you mentioned. One is through source redundancy. In other words, building lots more solar panels and wind turbines than we'll actually need at any one moment, because we know that at any one moment, a lot of them just aren't going to be working because there won't be sunshine or wind. So that adds to the overall cost of the system. I'll get back to that in a moment. The third strategy to deal with intermittency is just to shut off our energy usage when energy isn't available. And nobody wants to talk about that, of course, because we all just want to use energy all the time whenever we want to. So intermittency is a problem, but then there's also the problem of materials. You know, building all of these solar panels and wind turbines is going to take a lot of materials and batteries and transmission lines and so on. With fossil fuels, we've been mining coal, oil, and natural gas, you know, for the last couple of hundred years and taking a lot of those things out of the ground. But now we're talking about mining way, way more of, you know, copper and iron and aluminum and a whole range of minerals and metals that we'll be needing, even things as seemingly common as sand. You know, we're actually running short of the grades of sand that are necessary for making concrete, which is what we put wind turbines in when we put them up, and also silicon for, you know, making solar panels. So materials scarcity is going to be a limit to how far we can scale up renewables. Then scale itself is probably the biggest challenge. This is what David and I ultimately concluded. You know, any of the problems associated with the energy transition can be solved at the laboratory scale. In other words, let's take a problem like aviation. You know, it's going to be really hard to run airplanes on electricity because batteries are so much less energy dense than jet fuel, right? Jet fuel for the amount of energy you get per pound is way more energy dense than batteries. So that's a problem. So how do we solve that? Well, we, instead of just putting batteries on airplanes, we could make synthetic fuels. And you can do that in the laboratory. You can use solar panels to make electricity, then use electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, take the hydrogen, combine that with some CO2 that you've captured from the atmosphere with another set of machinery, and then you've got a synthetic fuel. It might be methane, it might be, you know, take your choice. There's a range of possible chemicals that you can make. But doing all of that is extremely inefficient. So doing it at scale to run today's airline industry or aviation industry is just not practical. I mean, the aviation industry is trying to figure out how to do all of this, obviously, because their survival is at stake, but they haven't come up with a good answer. So scale is a problem. And then the carbon pulse is a problem that gets talked about very, very little. You know, building all of this stuff, and we're talking about not just, you know, the turbines and solar panels and batteries and stuff, but all this energy using infrastructure, like, you know, transportation infrastructure, cars, airplanes, trains, ships, machines we use for heating and cooling buildings, manufacturing infrastructure that we use for altering materials from their raw state, from when they take them out of, we take them out of the ground, to finished materials that we can then use in manufacturing. All of that's a vast amount of machinery that we've built up over decades, and virtually all of it uses fossil fuels. So we're going to have to replace a huge amount of that machinery, and we're talking about doing all of this in just a couple of decades if we're going to meet the emissions targets set by the international agreements that we've made, like the Paris Agreement back in 2015. But building all of that stuff is going to take energy. And where's that energy going to come from? Well, most of it, 85%, at least in the initial stages, will have to come from fossil fuels, because that's where 85% of our current energy comes from. And so using all of that energy in a short period of time is going to create a lot of carbon emissions. So here's the paradox. The whole reason we're doing the energy transition is to reduce carbon emissions. But over the course of the energy transition, we'll actually be producing more carbon emissions in order to make the energy transition. And this is especially true because all of these technologies have energy usage front-loaded. In other words, with my electric car, it's much more energy efficient than a gasoline car. Over the course of the lifetime of my electric car, it will be responsible for far fewer carbon emissions. Okay, that's great. But the manufacturing of the car actually takes more energy than the manufacturing of a similar sized internal combustion engine car. Over the course of the lifetime of the car, it makes up for that because the electric motor is so much more efficient than an internal combustion engine motor. Okay, over the lifetime of the car, that's fine. But if we're trying to do an energy transition really fast, that means that we'll be building a lot of technologies, not like electric cars, also like solar panels, where the energy usage is all up front. With a solar panel, it takes a lot of energy to build it, but then over the course of 20 years, it more than pays back that energy. But, you know, again, with the front loading of the energy usage, that means if we try to do a fast energy transition, we're using a lot more energy than we would be normally. And most of that is going to be fossil fuels. So the materials problem, the energy and carbon pulse problem, the scale problem, and the problem of intermittency are really, really tough to overcome. You can do it in the laboratory at a small scale, but at the vast scale of energy usage that we have today globally, or even in North America, it's a problem that I don't think we're going to overcome. Realistically, the only way to do the energy transition is to reduce our energy usage very dramatically so that we don't have the carbon pulse and so that we don't deplete all of these rare materials from the Earth's crust that we use to build all of these machines. And so that we'll be able to continue living this way, more or less, you know, with some of these modern accoutrements like, communication technologies like we're using right now, maybe for at least a few more decades, maybe a few centuries, rather than having the whole thing just come crashing down, which is where we're headed right now. So I'm sorry, for the length of that answer, but it's a big question.
Everywhere we look, we see signs that all is not right with our Earth. Extreme temperatures and weather patterns wreak havoc. Pollutants sour soils, waterways, and our very bodies. And fires and floods ravage land and communities. We believe climate change is just a symptom of a larger ecological crisis. If we want change, we must realize that the solutions to the problems we face can't come through the same systems that created those problems in the first place.
Ecological justice requires that we challenge our assumptions about creation and our relationship to it. It requires decolonization. we must turn to the leadership of Indigenous communities who struggle for all life as land and water protectors. And we are calling on people of faith to join them.
We believe this so strongly, we wrote a book about it. It's called So That We and Our Children May Live, Following Jesus and Confronting the Climate Crisis. And it's published by Herald Press.
This book offers hope for a better future alongside concrete actions for joining with Indigenous peoples to protect life and negotiate with decision makers for sustainable change that follows Jesus. In these pages, we invite you with us to confront climate change and choose life for our children and the future of our planet.
We invite you to buy our book and join the conversation. Thank you.
So, Richard, so far you've really been talking about carbon and the transition away from using or burning fossil fuels. And so my next question is really sort of probing a little deeper into something beyond that. Why is climate change not the real problem, but only a symptom of a larger predicament? And we really appreciate how you use that word, predicament.
A problem is something you solve. A predicament is something that you deal with, usually by changing your own expectations and behavior. In the last year or so, this word polycrisis has come to be discussed more and more in circles of, you know, policymakers internationally. And the word has gained currency because there are so many problems converging at once, not just climate change, but there's a pretty long list. The proliferation of toxic chemicals in the environment. And I wrote a pretty lengthy article on this just recently, and other people have written excellent books on it about how, you know, whole classes of chemicals, and there are tens of thousands of chemicals out there that we put into the environment by the billions of tons per year. Whole classes of these chemicals disrupt reproduction in human beings and other animals. They are causing a die-off of insects. You know, we're losing about 2% per year of the biomass of insects on this planet. And 2% per year is an absolutely startling number. If we continue at that rate, by the end of this century, we'll have virtually no insect life left on the planet. And that means, you know, no birds, no, you know, it has ripple effects throughout ecosystems. We're losing wild nature, not just insects, but virtually all classes of mammals, amphibians, reptiles, fish, so on. Our oceans are in trouble. We're depleting raw materials, as I talked about earlier, both non-renewable materials like, you know, metals and minerals, but also renewable materials, forests, fish. We're over-harvesting renewables faster than they can regrow. And then there are problems of social crisis, like inequality. Economic inequality is growing in almost every country around the world. Certainly in the United States, but countries like China and India as well are seeing economic inequality growing at a rapid pace. And we know from history that when economic inequality increases rapidly, it results in political problems, social problems of all kinds, polarization, revolution, et cetera, et cetera. Then we have new technologies coming on board, like artificial intelligence. And I wrote an essay about this fairly recently also, quoting some of the developers of AI who are some of the most worried people on the planet looking at what AI can actually do. I mean, the obvious things are, you know, AI can produce fake video, fake photos, fake audio that are a propagandist's dream. You know, if propaganda was a problem during the 20th century, and if it's a problem sometimes in our elections, think of what it's going to be when it becomes literally impossible to tell fake video from real video. Then the level of unemployment that it's likely to cause. We just saw the writers' strike in Hollywood. They're concerned about AI, but virtually everybody should be who works with anything that could possibly be computerized. And again, the people who have developed AI are the most worried, because when they look forward in time, they see machines not just taking human jobs, but basically taking control of the whole human enterprise, because machines will be so much more efficient at it. They'll basically take over the economy, be making the decisions for us in defense applications, you know, Defense Department decisions and so on. It'll all be machines running the world. And what could possibly go wrong then? So, okay, all of these things are converging at once, you know, in our lifetime, right now in the 2020s. And they're all human-generated problems. It's not, you know, space aliens coming at us or asteroids hitting the Earth. We are creating all of these existential problems at the same time. So we really have to step back and say, what the hell is going on? Why are we doing this? And it really, you know, has to do with the size, the scale of the human enterprise, why it's gotten so big and so fast so recently. A lot of it traces back to fossil fuels, but some of it goes back further than that to the unleashed power of human enterprise that happened 500 years ago when Europeans developed sailing ships and guns and so on and took over whole continents. And
right.
You all are very aware of that and talk about it, thankfully. But after that happened, it created a whole mindset, especially in the Europeans, that there were no limits, that they could continue taking over more and more of the planet and growing richer and richer. And then when fossil fuels came along, that just put that attitude of limitless growth and limitless possibility, it put it on steroids. So now most people with a Western mindset really believe that there are no limits to what human beings can do. And all of these things that we've been talking about, all of these problems are just little, you know, glitches in the system. And once we iron them out, we're going to the stars. It's a, you know, it's a Star Trek future for us. I don't see it that way.
And needless to say, we do not as well. I mean, we really talk, as you know, in the book about this sort of wealth, expansionary wealth generating for individuals, limitless growth is just as we really trace it to kind of the colonization and the fact that we've just, the Western world has just, is in unreality, is not living in reality. I mean, that's really one of the core, Sarah, maybe you'll want to say a little bit more about this reality versus reality thing that we pose in the book that I think you're also talking about, mm-hmm. Richard.
Yeah, the extractive logic that dominates our culture. And so I'm talking about in the dominant culture in the United States and now beyond, that extractive logic is a fallacy. And it basically is based on this idea that the economy shapes reality, mm-hmm. when in fact our planet, which is a closed system of mutual dependence, that's what shapes actual reality. And this other thing on top of it is really a false reality. It's breaking the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I could interject a little bit that's in my most recent book that I think might be helpful for your readers. One of the questions that I have pondered for some time is, you know, why did fossil fuels take off in Britain basically, and then the United States in the 18th, 19th centuries. Why didn't it happen someplace else, the Industrial Revolution that changed the world so profoundly in ways we've been talking about? Well, I finally found the history of how this happened. And surprisingly, it almost happened 1,000 years earlier in China.
Right.
All of the ingredients were there. There was lots of coal, and the Chinese were starting to use coal for more and more purposes. They were inventing new technologies and digging up more and more coal. And they had an industrial revolution on their hands, but it was shut down by the existing power structure. The hereditary elites thought that this would be a threat to their social power. So it didn't happen in China 1,000 years ago. Instead, it waited another 700-800 years to happen in Britain and the United States. Well, why did it take off there? Why didn't it get shut down there in the same way? Well, the reason was, as a result of the era of so-called discovery, of conquest, these Europeans who grew extremely rich through all of the furs and the resources and everything else that was being taken out of the New World and brought back to sugar, et cetera, back to Britain and the continent. So there was this whole new powerful social class of entrepreneurs and traders who had already defeated the social power of the hereditary aristocracy. So the hereditary aristocracy was not in any place to shut down the new power sources that were flowing from fossil fuels. And the new class of entrepreneurs and traders were quite happy to embrace this disruptive, you know, change to fossil fuels. And so the Industrial Revolution happened here rather than 1,000 years ago. So capitalism and conquest are at the very heart of fossil fuels and also of the modern polycrisis that we were talking about earlier. All of these problems, from the disappearance of wild nature to the proliferation of toxic chemicals to climate change, are directly connected in a line of cause and effect back to the European conquest.
Wow. Thank you for that, Richard, because we also make that link, but we didn't do it in that way. And that is a really important piece of the story that I think that can be added along to the story we're telling, the story of capitalism and colonization that we're telling in the book. Thank you for that.
Around the globe, dreams ignite communities, but for many in the global south, opportunities are limited. For 70 plus years, MIDA has sparked lasting change in resilient communities worldwide through sustainable development, providing entrepreneurs with access to training, mentorship, and the resources they need to build stronger businesses. Join us. Together, let's pave the way for a just and equitable world where everyone thrives, because every dream deserves a chance. Visit givesolutions.org today.
We are living in this unreality or this fallacy of individualism while we all of us reap the benefit of our collective action. We say that it's individualist, but it isn't really. Yeah. And so in terms of the green transition, or, you know, the just green transition, they're calling it, which I think is funny. there is so much of an emphasis on individual action and not on collective action. And I wonder if you could comment on that. And so from my point of view, that would be, rather than building electric cars, figuring out how to live without cars.
Yeah.
Which would require actually a transit system that would enable all of us to be able to get around, and with minimal use of cars.
Yeah.
So for example, but I'm wondering if you
comment. Well, you know, we have created this this infrastructure in the US that demands that we use lots of energy. You know, I have some friends down in the Bay Area who have a nonprofit called Global Footprint Network, and they analyze the ecological footprint of nations by, you know, how much of biocapacity is used by human beings on an annual basis. And of course, a lot of nations, particularly, you know, wealthy nations like the U.S., are in ecological overshoot. We use more of Earth's biocapacity than can be regenerated on an annual basis, and by a lot. So if everybody lived the way people in North America do, we would need 4 or 5 Earths worth of productivity. Okay. So that's the result of a collective set of decisions that were made over a period of time. And most of us weren't directly involved in those decisions. And even if we were not aware of the ultimate implications. You know, decisions like how to design our towns and cities. You know, should we design them so that you can walk everywhere? Or should we design them so that we assume that everybody's going to have a car? You know, if you want to get your kids to school, if you want to go shopping, if you want to get to work, well, what are the options? Well, theoretically, there might be a bus that goes there, but realistically, everybody's got to have their own personal transportation appliance that, you know, is implicated in, you know, tons and tons of resource use and ends up in a junkyard at the end of the day.
Right.
So we're not going to be able to get out of this situation just through individual action. You know, like my wife and I, we try to recycle. We have, you know, I mentioned we have the solar panels and we have electric solar cookers and all of this stuff. Great. But we're not changing the city around us very much, you know. And even if everybody in Santa Rosa, where we live, were to start to make similar choices, the reality is that there's all of this infrastructure still in place and will probably continue to be in place for decades to come that will force most people to make decisions about energy usage. And that's why when I mentioned the Global Footprint Network, if you want to calculate your personal ecological footprint, you know, you have to put in your place of residence. What country do you live in? And if you live in the U.S., you automatically have a bigger footprint than somebody in some other country, even if you're doing all the right things and you're growing your own food and everything else.
We're not talking about changing individual hearts and minds. I'm not saying that's not a piece of it, but I love my Mennonite people, but we really love to focus on individual simple living. And that's great, you know, right? I mean, Mennonites are kind of known as being these simple livers, although in actuality, that's often not true. But it's a really highly held value, and it's lovely, and it's actually not going to get us very far.
To bring about social change through demanding different systems. I mean, the people who built these systems are not smarter than we. You know, this didn't sort of evolve out of the ground, like come up like mushrooms. It was created by human beings. It can be dismantled by human beings and replaced by human beings.
That's right.
We not only have the ability, we must do that. So just speaking to what you're saying, Sherry, it's not enough to just say, well, you know, I'm not implicated. You know, I'm pure of heart and, you know, recycle all my things, you know, and ride the bus to work. We have to actually work together to demand a systems-wide response. I mean, I would also just say, based on what you were saying, Richard, the way that our towns and cities were arranged were purposefully also arranged to reinforce racial segregation and economic segregation.
Right.
You know, freeways gave us that, you know, highways and freeways and roads. And those things can be dismantled when we have this new, beautiful opportunity to change our world so that we can continue to live. That's actually an opportunity. We're alive now. How do we take this moment and say, let's imagine together what else there is. This doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah.
People don't get that when I talk that, because I often am delivering sort of a limits to growth kind of message to people. And also that polycrisis message of like, hey, climate change is only a symptom of a larger problem, which is this ecological overshoot. And, you know, talk about people wanting to stop their ears and go, la, 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 you know, that's, but I actually find it hopeful, because I guess what I think is we have no choice. We are going to have to change. Like, it's going to be forced upon us. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that's true. That there are some pitfalls along the way. I mean, when you say change will be forced upon us, some people find that very threatening. And there's I see a proliferation of kind of conspiracy theories these days. You know, it's all the fault of George Soros. It's all the fault of the World Economic Forum. Or, you know, there are these powerful, evil people behind the scenes who are making all these decisions and forcing us to live this way or that way. I'm sure that there are lots of, you know, evil people behind the scenes who are just trying to get rich and do all these things. But, you know, I've been around for long enough and been in conferences with, you know, people at various levels of local government and national government and so on, to know that a lot of these people are just trying to get by and solve some problems in the short amount of time they have. And they just, you know, it's beyond their ability to address the big overall problems that we've been talking about, if they even understand them. And when they come up with an idea like, wow, you know, we should design our towns so that everybody can get where they need to go by walking, somebody else hears that and they say, oh, that's the World Economic Forum that's telling us, you know, that we should all live a certain way, and they're going to take our cars away from us, just like they're going to take our guns away from us. All of this conspiracy theorizing that's going on, I think is a natural human reaction to threat and change. The only thing that's going to get us beyond that is, you know, to think more critically and to talk to each other more honestly and openly, so that we see that we're all in this together. In fact, all of us in this human family, and beyond the human family to the whole family of life, we're all in this situation together. So the solution is not going to be to find those few evil people, identify them, and get rid of them. The solution is going to be to come together and see what's actually needed and make some sacrifices in a shared and compassionate way.
Well, amen to that. Your most recent book, Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival. I know my understanding, I think I have this right, is it's kind of your magnum opus. I don't know if you think of it as that, but it really, I think, is bringing together a lot of the decades of your work. Yeah. Is that true? And please say whatever. I think I said, give us the longish elevator pitch, for, you know, not the 90-second version, but the slightly longer version of that book.
I'm happy to do that.
Say about it.
Thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, it is my magnum opus. And I don't think it will be my best-selling book, unfortunately, but it's the book that I've put the most into in terms of research and thought. The title, again, is Power. And my aim in the book is to explain, to find out for myself, which is what I always do with my writing. I use writing as an excuse to sort out my own thinking, to sort out what is power? How does it work? Power is a word that we all use all the time. But in my experience, not very many of us think in a very disciplined way about what power is and how it works. I think you have to start with physical power, which is basically energy. The physicist would define power as the rate of energy transfer measurable in watts or horsepower, right? But we use energy to do things. So everything we do requires energy. So we speak of the power of flight or the power of speech. That's using energy to do certain things. But then there's also social power, because we humans are social animals. So social power is the ability to get other people to do things. And that could be, you know, forcing other people to do things, or enticing them to, or inspiring them to. There are many different kinds of social power. And over the course of human history, our physical power has increased in various ways through stages, developing language and tools all the way up to fossil fuels. And our social power has increased also. And the main tools of social power have been money, which we've only had for about 5,000 years or so, but it has greatly increased the power of some people to tell other people what to do. So money, metal weapons of all kinds, but especially metal weapons, have had a huge influence in history, especially the last 500 years, in giving some people power over others. And communication technologies, starting with writing, but now all going all the way up to computers and social media. Communication technologies always give some people power over other people, whether it's Hitler's use of the radio and Mussolini, or the use of propagandists in Russia and various places today of, social media and our new communication tools. So these are the tools of social power. And the thing is, power is good. We couldn't do anything without power, right? Power is necessary for everything we do, but it's possible to have too much of a good thing. And humanity today has too much physical power over the rest of the world via fossil fuels. And we have too much social power, because we have so much economic inequality that just a few people are able to call the shots for millions and millions of others. And this is not a healthy situation. So it's going to require us to voluntarily rein in our power over the world and over each other. This is not a popular idea, because again, we've gotten used to this idea that there are no limits and we human beings are, the stars are our destiny and all this stuff. But if you start to look at nature in terms of how it regulates its own power, the whole world opens up. In fact, everything in nature limits its own power in various ways in order to survive. Whether it's carnivores that restrict their predation in order to so that they don't kill all the game, or whether it's our own bodies and the ways the organs of our bodies work together and limit their own operation, their own energy usage, so that we have homeostasis, so the human body works properly. Okay, so we are theoretically capable of reigning in our own power, and we do it all the time with laws and regulations and traditions. And indigenous people have done it forever, because my definition of indigenous is you've been in one place long enough to learn the rules, to learn the limits, and to learn how to live for a long time within those limits. Okay, so it's possible to do, but we modern human beings have a lot of relearning to do in order to get back within those limits of powers.
We talk about limits to growth, but I think I love the reframe as limits to power. Like, we have to actually limit our own power as certain kinds of humans, those of us, the Western humans, in order to actually make this a survivable, in order to survive.
Absolutely. That's it.
So, Richard, I had asked for, and one of the things I'm really fascinated by is the fact that I forget who says this, but one of the functions of religion, when it's being used properly, is to place necessary limitations on people. Yeah. Like, you know, morality is just a way of like limiting people so that they don't cause harm to each other and to the planet. It's living in right relationship is what I call it. Yeah. What does it mean to live in right relationship with oneself, the planet, with each other? And that there are necessary limits you have to put on yourself and in societies in order to live in right relationship. And that actually when religion is functioning in a healthy way, it does that. It does that, mm-hmm. as can philosophy or cosmology or other, you know, culture can do that too. But that's the part where we actually have to change culture.
Yeah.
We talk about changing structures a lot, but we also talk about what does it mean to change culture? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to celebrate a culture of limit setting, mm-hmm. as opposed to celebrate a culture of endless expansion and growth?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. As I'm sure you know, the word... Yeah. Religion comes from the Latin religare, which means to bind back. So we need to, bind ourselves back to what really matters, where we come from.
But all these things are firing in my brain that I want to now.
Cool. That's the sign of a good conversation.
I can see Sarah's brain going, and I'm just like, watch out, Richard, because. When Sarah starts talking to you, you find your life changes, which is what happened to me.
Right.
So, anyways.
That sounds good.
Join us. We need you.
This podcast is hosted by us, co-produced by the DD&D Coalition and Anabaptist World.
The opinions expressed here are ours, however, and do not reflect official positions of Anabaptist World.
For more information, go to anabaptistworld.org and dofdmeno.org.
Our theme music is by Micah Peplow and Shannon Kaler. Thank you.